class today. Before we begin, does anybody have any comments, questions, concerns, or other things to bring up for me? Okay, then, I have a question for all of you related to the homework. So we gave you 20 days to work on this assignment because we thought you might need 20 days. So I'm just sort of curious how well we're doing. So how many of you actually have something moving across the screen? Okay, well, I won't bother asking the rest of these questions. I would encourage you, get with your partner and work on this. We'll give you some time to do it in lab, but you want more time than that, and you really don't want to wait till the last minute. There's a fair amount of deciding what to do in this homework assignment, and you don't want to be trying to decide what to do the same time you're trying to get your code done in a few hours. So I strongly encourage you to work on this early. Make the TA's life interesting, even though homework isn't due for 3 weeks. All right. Anybody have any questions about the homework? Okay. So the next thing I want to do is talk a little bit about programming languages. This class we teach you Java. I will go ahead. We're going to make a list here. So we are learning Java. Okay? Java is far from being the only programming language. Several years ago, there was a recent study that showed that there were over 2,000 languages with more than 100 people programming them actively. I personally know in the neighborhood of 70 languages. But I want to talk briefly, let's just sort of say, what are some computer languages people know of? Yes?
C++.
There's C++. Yeah?
Python.
We have a C Sharp.
Ruby.
Is that it? Yeah.
HTML.
Okay, we have HTML5.
Spin.
LabVIEW.
Fortran.
Basic. I can't spell basic. CSS.
PowerShell.
JavaScript. Pascal. Sorry, E what, Del?
QPL6.
Ah, finally, one I haven't heard of before.
Perl.
Okay, so there's lots of languages. We only managed to come up with 17 of them. I know 70. Surprise, we're not doing real well here, but that's all right. I want to talk about these different languages. Why do I want to talk about these languages? Well, partly because you're probably going to be programming something other than Java for most of the rest of your life. Java is a very popular language. It's somewhere in the top four. It's growing in popularity very rapidly because Android is written in Java. So Java is just skyrocketing in popularity as a consequence right now. But there are so many other languages, you'll probably be working something else. So I want to try to give you some feeling for how these languages differ. And we'll talk in each of these cases sort of how this shows up in Java and how this changes how you write code for this class as well. So that's my goal for today. So let me start by distinguishing between programming languages and not. So Java is a programming language. Most of these are programming languages. But some of them aren't. I actually don't know anything about Spin. Sorry. LabVIEW, Fortran. Yikes. Excel doesn't like me today. Basic. CSS is not. Oop. Yeah. Did it just change modes on me again? All right. But this is a no. This is a yes. 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 I don't know anything about that one either. All right. So, some of these are not programming languages. What does that mean? HTML is what we call a markup language. The purpose of HTML is not to describe how to do something, not to program your computer, but to describe how something looks In the case of HTML, I'll describe how websites look. Okay? And CSS and HTML5 are both related to HTML in a very direct way. They're all describing how web pages look. And that's their purpose. They do not describe how to do things. Now, sometimes when people use HTML5, they use it to include JavaScript, which is a programming language. But programming languages describe how to do something in your computer. Other languages describe how to how things look, describe data, something like that. So learning HTML is a lot easier than learning Java, because you're not trying to worry about loops, you're not worrying about conditions, you're just worrying about, is this a paragraph, is this bold, is there an image here? Sort of relatively straightforward concepts. On the other hand, learning Java won't help you write HTML, but it will help you write all of these other programs. Okay? So a lot of what we've talked about is transferable to these other languages. But the next thing I want to talk about is types. So last class, we talked a little bit about how memory is stored in our computer. We said it's high or low voltages. And then the same set of high or low voltages can be interpreted in different ways, depending on what type Java is expecting somewhere. Okay? So an int and a float are stored the same inside your computer. They're both just 32 high or low voltage things. And by making a different interpretation of them, we treat it as either an int or a float with different behaviors depending on which one we do. Similarly for short and char, for double and long, and so on. They're the same size, same number of bits, but the type changes how we think of them. And types become very important as we deal with creating our own. Right? So the method that we are invoking on an object depends on the type of that object. So when I call the next int method of a scanner, I get something different than if I were to call next int on a random number generator or so on. So there's a lot of influence on types. There are basically two kinds of type systems out there. There are many more, but mostly there are two. We have what are called static types, and we have what are called dynamic types. And we're going to talk a little bit about this difference, then we'll come back and sort of talk about how these things go. But to talk about the difference between static and dynamic types, I'm going to talk about filing systems. Okay? So, most of us have lots of numbers in our life. We have telephone numbers and social security numbers and student ID numbers and addresses that have numbers in them, and you may have all kinds of other numbers around. Just CIS alone assigns 3 numbers to every student. I've never figured out why. Lots and lots of numbers in our life. And arguably, all of these numbers are the same, right? There's nothing intrinsic that makes one 10-digit number different from another. It's the type that we interpret that tells us whether it's a social security number, a telephone number, or an ISBN, or what it is. So we're going to pretend that there are two people. One person has a very unusual filing system. The way they remember their types is by remembering where they put it. So they've got a lot of post-it notes, and they write a number on each one. And they just decide, I'm going to put my mother's telephone number on the left bedpost. And I'm going to put my social security number underneath my desk chair. And they just find a place for every number. And then when they want to find something, they just go to that place and they say, ah, because I found this on my left bedpost, it must be my mother's telephone number. Okay? There's no annotation. Each of the post-it notes just has a number, and the location tells them what it means. The other person writes on every note what it is. So they write on the note, mother's telephone number, colon, and then the number. And they write another note, my student ID number, and the number, and so on. And then they don't really care where they put them. They just have numbers. They can stick them wherever. They can move them around. Because on the note itself, it tells you what type of number it is. This idea is the idea between static and dynamic types. So in Java, we are static types, which means that the place where we're storing something gets a type. The variable itself stores one type of thing. It's where we put it that tells it where it is. It is storing things by remembering where we put the number. Okay? In dynamic typing, we don't do that. In dynamic typing, we store the type with the value itself. Okay? So in dynamic typing, it is okay to write, for example, x equals 3, X equals high, because the number 3 and the string high will store their values directly. And I can change what type of thing is being stored in a particular place, a particular variable, as I go along. Questions about the thought? Okay, so if I were to write code in a dynamic typed language, I never have to say types. I just assume variables exist, I give them values, values intrinsically have types, and away we go. Less typing. I don't need to worry about types, I don't have to worry about return types, I don't have to worry about parameter types, I don't have to worry about variable types, because the values themselves tell me what their type is. It's written down with them. And a lot of languages are dynamically typed. So this one's dynamic, this one's dynamic, this one's dynamic, this one's dynamic, dynamic, dynamic. Okay, so over half of these languages we've identified are dynamically typed. So, let's just see what we think. What would be good about writing in a dynamically typed language or a statically typed language? Let's try to make a case for one over the other, based on this very brief summary. You think of something that makes one of them sound better than the other. Let's start with this. Dynamically typed sounds cooler than statically typed. I still don't understand the difference. Statically typed sounds cooler than dynamically typed. Wow, we all think dynamically typed sounds cooler. Okay, great. Why? Why is dynamically typed cooler? Some brave soul, voice the opinion of the masses. Yes?
Less typing.
Less typing. I put less characters in my files and it works. Hurrah! Why else? Any other reasons? So less typing is the big one. Okay? That's the main reason people like it. But there's a big problem with less typing. And the problem is it's hard to read the code. When I look at some method in Java, I know a lot about that method based purely on the types that are involved. If I see a method called add and it takes integers, as opposed to taking lists, I know what kind of adding it is talking about. If I see that method in a language that doesn't have types, or the types are dynamic, I don't know that from looking at it. So it's harder to read the code. Okay? Easier to write it, harder to read it. It also tends to run a lot slower. Most dynamically typed languages are somewhere around 300 times slower than a statically typed language. It varies a little bit. Some are more like 5,000 times slower. But they're all a lot slower, because the program itself has to check the type of every value before it does something. And that really slows down the computer quite a lot. So types exist. And there's something to think about. As you're looking at a new language, you can tell very quickly if it's statically typed or not. Because the very first time they assign a value to a variable, they either have to tell you the type of the variable or they don't. And if they don't assign the type of the variable, then you can generally assume, with a few exceptions like Haskell, but in most cases you can assume that this is a language where the types are stored with the values, and the same variable can be reused for many different purposes, and reading the code will be harder than it would in a statically typed language. Okay, so we have these two filing systems, these two ways of remembering what types of things we're dealing with. And Java is statically typed. Statically typed is almost always used for larger pieces of code, and it also has some benefits educationally because you see what's happening more. Okay? But almost all large systems, almost all code that's designed for large systems is statically typed. Okay? So all these languages, the C, C++, Objective-C, Java, all the systems languages that write your operating systems, write your large programs and games and so on, we do static typing because it's faster and because it lets us write big things without getting confused. So that happens. Let's also talk just a little bit about how Java stores things internally. So when I see code like int X equals 3, then somewhere Java is going to make room for a variable called X. And the way we've been representing this is as a name in a box. Okay, so we would put X, and then we have some value here. We would put 3 as the value of it. So we had some sort of name and value. Okay, and we put these in some memory associated with the method in question. And then if we said X equals X plus 2 plus 3, it would read the old value of X, use that in the math, and change the value of X, and away it goes. It's sort of this basic table. But Java actually remembers one more piece of information besides this. It also remembers the type. Okay? Because every variable has only one type, it knows the type that's associated with a spot in memory. So for each new variable I have, I make a string variable s equals h. Okay? I make a new variable, and it's going to put that type of value in memory with that name. And then remember, we said we store arrows. We don't actually store arrows. We store something called addresses, where to find this string. So we store some sort of, you can find it over there. It won't let me put an at sign. Let's see if we can fix that. There we are. So we have one part of memory that stores type, name, and value. And we have some other part of memory that has addresses and values. Okay? That's where we store objects. Okay? Every address has a value over there. And we can put those addresses in different fields. So the string variable s is currently pointing over to that object. Okay? But if later I were to say s equals s plus s, I would look up the string s. I would see it goes over here to this h object. I would do the plus, which makes a longer string. So some new hh string would appear with some different address. And I would change the address that I'm storing to be that new one. Okay? So we've seen this in pictures before. But this is essentially what's happening under the hood. Sometimes we're working directly in the boxes. Sometimes the boxes are pointing out to some other part of memory where we store the objects and the arrays and so on. Questions about that? Yes?
Does the 3546 address still contain the letter H once you change string?
It does. So the old address doesn't go away. Remember how we talked about garbage collection before? The old value of H is now garbage. I know it's now garbage because nothing in the named variables points to it. I have no way of knowing that there is anything in 3546 except sort of historical interest. So when the garbage collector will come along, eventually it'll come along and it'll say, oh look, this address, nobody's talking about this address. We can throw it away and reuse that memory. But it may take a long time to do that. Just as we saw on Friday, right? The kittens may last a long time before the garbage collector decides they're disposable. Same thing is true of strings and every other kind of object in Java.
Can it store a different type if you reuse the
memory? If I reuse the memory, I can put a new type there, yes. So Java actually does store the type over here as well. Okay, so it does have a type for these. It does have a type for these values as well. But when it reclaims that memory, it can also change the type that's being stored there. Because how does it know the type? It doesn't actually have to store it. We knew the type based on the type of thing that variable was pointing to. Right? So if I had something, some other type of variable pointing there, we could infer that it was that other type. All that we're really storing in these boxes is lots of ones and zeros, lots of high and low voltages. And what those mean depend entirely on the type that we are using to access them. So Java will choose to interpret this particular set of ones and zeros as a string, as a kitten, as a random object, as a scanner, as some type of thing based on the type that we put in the variable. Other questions? Okay, now, it is tangentially interesting at best, but nonetheless true, that the only part of this actually makes it into memory is this stuff. Okay? Just the values actually go onto your computer's memory. Because from the source code that we're writing in Java, we can figure out how to interpret things without ever needing to store the names or the variables. So we put the H at this port of your memory. Your memory is addressed by really big numbers in the order of several billion numbers. Okay? And by putting the bits that represent H in a particular spot, we now have that mapping between that spot and its value. So we actually put it there. And then for the ones in the methods memory that we had a name and a type, we can get rid of those too in a process called compilation. So when you, every time you save your Eclipse file, when it decides if they are red squigglies or not, it is doing something called compiling your program. It is turning it from Java source code into something much closer to what the machine is doing. And all of your variables get replaced by the addresses of where that thing is in memory, including these ones here, right? So even the values that you gave names, that name gets forgotten because the name you picked is not important to Java to run. So there's this extra step of we write some source, and then that gets compiled into something the computer can run. And it throws away as many details as it can because it doesn't care about those details anymore. So it stores relatively little information, just the values, but the compiler, the thing that's deciding how to make the code, understands the types and values, the types and names of all of your variables as well. So that happens. If we were to talk about a different type of language, okay, something like Python or JavaScript or Ruby or Perl or something like that where we dynamically typed, then what we would store instead would include the type. So we would have the name X, and then we would store something like int 3. We'd have the variable y, and we'd store something like string hi. And then when we assign x again, we would take that string hi and we'd put it over there. There are still addresses going on and so on. There's actually a lot more addresses, so I'm not going to try to draw them all. But the idea here is that the type actually goes into memory. Okay? The type is stored in the memory of the computer. It is used as we move forward. And that's how dynamic typed languages work. So a variable doesn't have a type in a language like Perl or JavaScript or Python or so on. Variables don't have types. Their values do. In Java, the variables do have types. And so we only have to store the value. Yes?
Static and dynamic. Do all variables also have addresses along the same continuum, such that the real difference between normal variables and objects would be that objects have two addresses instead of one?
So every piece of memory has an address, and everything I put in memory has some place in memory it's put. So yes, everything has an address, including these values we're putting over here in the method memory of the stack, as well as the method things we're putting over here in the heap. But we use those addresses differently. I don't know how much I want to say about that. It is a lot easier for the computer to use these addresses. We don't need a garbage collector for these because we're just sort of stacking things up. And when we return, we can just throw away the most recent thing we stacked. Whereas over in the heap, things are much more chaotic. Trying to keep track of what's going on is hard. Although this stuff over here on the stack has addresses, we never use those addresses because we always sort of know where they are in advance. There's lots of details here, but in general, local variables are a lot cheaper. If we can put the primitive directly there, we're good. If it's too big or too complicated or variable size or something, we'll put it somewhere else and use the address instead. And that's true in both dynamic and static type languages.
Thank you.
You're welcome. There are languages that store nothing but addresses in this space. Okay? So actually, Python has the feature, and Ruby as well, both have the feature, that everything is an object. Even int isn't really a primitive. It is stored somewhere over in the heap. And that slows it down even further, but it's already so slow, nobody really cares. Any other questions about this idea? All right, so as you move forward in your life, If you end up majoring in computing, you will get to write big programs in statically typed languages that are easy to read and take a long time to type. If you don't, you'll most likely work with dynamically typed languages. Bits of JavaScript when you're writing a web page, or bits of Perl, or Python, or MATLAB, or LabVIEW, or whatever. And so you'll likely spend a lot of time working with these dynamically typed languages with 20, 30 line pieces of code, at the very most, as opposed to tens and thousands of lines of statically typed code. Most of the ideas we've talked about just carry over directly. Assignments and loops and so on, even the strange syntax of the for loop is shared by a surprisingly large number of languages. But the details of how types work do differ, and so it's something I wanted to make sure you saw before you move on and get to see more of these things. Okay. All that said, I want to talk a little bit about the idea of what makes a language good. Okay? So, let's suppose I have two programs. And I want to say one is better than the other. What are some criteria I could use to decide which one is better? Yes? Less ambiguous. Okay? Ambiguous. Yeah?
Faster.
Uh-huh.
Less code.
Yeah.
Easier to read.
Uh-huh.
Easier for users to interface with.
Easier for users to use. Yeah.
Easier to teach.
Okay. Apparently, I am having difficulty spelling easier in some cases. Okay, let's pause, not think like computer scientists for a moment. Let's consider some actual programs you use you've seen different versions of. Let's say, what have you almost certainly seen many versions of? How about Firefox versus Chrome versus Opera versus Internet Explorer versus Galileo versus Conqueror versus whatever your favorite thing is? How do you decide which one's good? Yeah. Intuitive user interface. Yeah. Most keyboard shortcuts. Is that it? Yeah.
Design appeal.
Design appeal, which I'm going to call prettier. Okay, honestly, isn't that how we usually decide at first? This looks kludgy. This doesn't. Okay, actually one of the biggest ones is habit. If I have spent the time learning how to use my Android interface, I will be annoyed by iPhone. This has nothing to do with whether iPhone or Android is better. It's that I've already put in the habit necessary to learn the Android interface. Or vice versa if I learned iPhone first. Right? Habit's a big thing. Lots of things that can make one program better than another. Static versus dynamic typing is part of this, right? How we're storing variables changes this stuff right up here. Okay? The less ambiguous, the faster, the less code, the easier to read. Something we didn't mention anywhere here. Correctness. Okay, so, quick poll. I mean, think about the last time you had a computer crash on you. Okay? Either a single program did something it shouldn't do, so you saw some error in your software. How many of you have not seen an error for the past week? It's been at least a week since the last error you saw in your code. Hands nice and high, be proud, you are the lucky few. Zero. Everybody's seen an error in the past week. Okay, how about in the past 3 days? So since Friday, I've seen something fail. Yes, since Friday, I have seen something fail since Friday. Okay, more than half of us. I've seen something fail in the last 24 hours. So since 1 o'clock on Sunday, I saw something fail. Still a signal like a quarter of us. How about since 10 o'clock this morning, something failed? Still a reasonable number of us. Okay, now, what's weird about this? Why? How many of you have seen your a car fail in the past week? Not even when you're driving. Just any car at all, you've seen it fail. Three of us? Okay. How many of you have seen a kitchen appliance fail in the past month? Two, three, four. Four of us. Okay, why? Why do we see computers fail almost every day? Pick almost anything else. How many of you have seen a chair fail in the past year? We're like, maybe 30 of us. So what's wrong with computers? Why are they breaking all the time? All the time. I mean, if chairs broke every day, we would all learn how to stand, right? So why? Why do we accept so many failures? Why do we have so much bad code? Yeah. They're developed faster. Okay. So let's see here. Why do computers break? They're developed faster. So we're just being lazy. We're not fixing all the bugs. And if we made a chair as quickly as we make code, the chairs would break too. Reasonable explanation. Other thoughts? Yeah. There are more computers. Okay. Let's think about this for a moment. Try to count up how many programs you have used in the past week. Let me do this for a moment. So I think I'm seeing somewhere between 30 and 40. Count up how many chairs you've used in the past week. I'm seeing somewhere in the neighborhood of 20. Okay. This isn't significantly different. If you have a different experience, great. Good thought. It may just be the number of exposures. Other thoughts. Why might computers break all the time? Yes. They're complex. Okay? Complexity certainly figures in. Yes. They're new. Okay? Yeah.
Failure isn't usually dangerous.
Failure is not dangerous. Why would that mean they could break all the time?
Because they don't really have a factor of safety involved.
Yeah. If you see a car break, at the very least, that keeps you from going where you're going. Often it causes people bodily injury and lawsuits and so on. Very rarely does the fact your web browser crash cause you anything more than minor inconvenience. Right? So the cost of a failure is fairly low. Other reasons, though. Why else are there so many more failures? Yeah. Okay? So I thought you were saying one thing, it turns out you're saying something else. So, viruses. Viruses can make things break. There's a very famous virus called Stuxnet that destroyed most of Iran's nuclear reactors or nuclear refinement facilities, right? They can destroy physical stuff as well as computers. Most of the time, though, computers don't break because of viruses. Viruses are a big deal. Most viruses' goal is to actually make your computer work well so that you'll leave it on your computer and then send out spam. But that's a topic perhaps for another day. Yeah, we may talk some more about it. Anyway, there's also the fact that code is easy to change. In a single semester, I just taught almost 600 people the basics of changing code. And there's nothing stopping you from going to almost any Android application and changing it, because Android is written in Java. You may not have any idea what you're doing, which will just increase the chance you'll break it. Hurrah! We're getting in the right direction. Other ideas why things break a lot? There's a really big one. We expect them to break. If I buy a chair and it breaks in the first month I own it, I will be irate. I will demand my money back. Right? If I buy a computer and it breaks in the first month I own it, I will reboot and keep going. Right? The end. There's no or very little monetary incentive to make a computer correct. We are programmers and businesses are lazy. They make just little enough to get the money they want and they move on. And this has probably happened for most of your code. For example, in homework 5, over half of the submissions, when I compiled them, told me that you had done something wrong and told me how to break them. And I could have just gone in and, if I wanted to, broken half of your submissions with just a few strokes of a keyboard. And why? Well, partly because I didn't tell you how to check the warnings, but also partly because why would you do more than you have to? And that doesn't stop. When you're not doing things for grades, it just continues. I want to write a word processor. I just need it to be reliable enough that people don't complain they're losing their files very often. And that's it. Most software is shipped with a license agreement that says there is no warranty of any kind, including fitness for a particular purpose or merchantability. In other words, they tell you up front, this is so bad quality that that it is immoral to sell it, and it is not useful for any purpose at all. It's written in the legal document of almost every piece of software you own. Okay? Which is just strange. Why are we paying money for this? And mostly it's because we're willing to. We expect them to break. That's the world we have come to expect, so why would anybody invest effort to do otherwise? There are lots of ways to make code more correctly. We have a professor at UVA, John Knight, who believes that every program ought to contain a proof that it is correct. And he spends a lot of effort talking about this, and if you ever get to take a class from him, you'll get to learn about how you can do this. And it can be done. I have proven programs correct, reasonably sized ones. It's painful. It is slow. It takes so long to write a proof. So we don't. We just make quick ones to throw away. Okay. Lots of things that can make programs better or worse than others. Lots of things that can make them break, and reasons why we expect that. Part of that is how we declare types. Part of it is our understanding of what the computer is actually doing. The more programs you write, the more failures you will experience. That doesn't go away, because we'll typically just move forward with bigger and bigger programs, so we're always writing ones big enough that we don't really understand everything they're doing. And that's part of the experience of software engineering for most people. It doesn't have to be. You can move slower, but that typically happens. So as we're thinking about programs, it's worth remembering these various ideas. Now, how does all of this impact coding? Let's talk about the homework. Okay? So we have this homework. You get to see an example of how it runs. Hurrah, so you have some idea what you're trying to shoot for. We give you some basic code, some to-do places where you ought to do things, and talk about some of the ideas of what it should do. And there's lots of ways you can go from there. Some of you will immediately start writing code. And I just asked you at the beginning of class, how much code have you written? Which suggests that I sort of want you to do that, which is wrong. Okay? What you ought to try doing is writing little code, small pieces that work by themselves. So I designed this homework assignment, which means I had to write it before any of you did. And the first version of the program I ran had 3 lines only. And then I ran a version of the program that had 5 lines. And then I ran a version that had 4 lines because one of those 5 was wrong. And then I ran a version that had 7 lines. Right? And I just kept working. Tiny little pieces. And then once I figured out how to make the window show up so that I could give you a window, I put that aside and I started over with another 3-line program that just did the basics of how a bird works. And I worked back and forth and tried several different versions of the basics of a bird until I got one I could explain well. And then I said, okay, stop that. Now let's go and figure out how we draw pictures. And I spent lots of tiny little programs to draw this little picture and that little picture and put them together. And this is usually the right way to write programs. Because if they're small, you can fit the whole thing in your head at once. And when something goes wrong, you have the entire idea there and you can see what must have failed. And so typically, as you're designing programs, right? One of the things we say here is you should have gravity. And so it's worth your while thinking, what does gravity look like in code by itself, independent of everything else? How can I make a small program that tests if my idea about gravity is correct? Can I insert that into some code I already have? Maybe I can put it in my asteroids or so on. Get gravity working. Play with it. See how you change the numbers and it changes how fast gravity works. And you say, great, I understand gravity. Now let's understand something else. So we throw gravity away and we start working on the next task. Okay? And then once I know how gravity works, I know keys work, and I know how flapping works, and I know how drag works, then I can try putting them all together. Most programs that are written to be disposed within the hour. And this will remain true forever, okay? You will write little code either to test out an idea or to just do one task. I probably write on average a dozen programs of less than 5 lines every day. Just to do little bits and pieces of things that I want to have done along the way. And getting in that practice of writing these little programs is a really good practice, both for developing things like your homework assignments, as well as just understanding how things work. Okay. Make sure I've hit most of what I really wanted to hit today. Questions, comments, thoughts about anything we've covered so far before I hit one last topic? Okay. Let's look at the schedule. Let me just... It's worthwhile reminding ourselves where we've come. So I know many of you are frustrated at the test, right? You feel like you're not doing as well as you should. But if you think about where we started, the vast majority of you started not even knowing what a language was. And when you were playing with Turtle, it was all just complete mysteries what was happening. You were copying lines of code and moving them around, right? And as we went along, we saw a little bit about types. We've seen a lot more later. We've seen how to read things, write if statements, looping. We got to see that it snows a lot, right? We got to play around with files and understand how we read them and split them and what arrays are, what lists are. We've written methods, right? We've used methods right from the beginning to draw squares and circles with our turtles, but we got to see what they're doing. We've got to see how we write our own types. And now we've got to see how that some of that works under the hood. As we move forward from here, I'm going to talk some ideas about speed, simplicity, correctness, how you trade these things off. So Wednesday we'll devote a lot more to this idea about what makes programs good. We'll talk some about how you design a solution to a problem. Okay, we'll give some practical tips as well as some general things about how you design things. We'll play around with recursion. We saw recursion before. That's how we drew trees, a method that invokes itself. We'll spend a full week talking about how that works. And then talk a little bit more about how you can use classes together. At the end of this, and actually even already right now, you know enough to make money writing code. Hey, as witnessed by the fact that Joust is a much more complicated game than Angry Birds. It's a more complicated game than Flappy Birds. It's a more complicated game than most of the games they've made a lot of money online recently. And once you know how to do this, you know how to do a lot of things. You can already do big things. And part of the reason there's so much broken code is because of that. Right? Many of you will never take another programming class. You will graduate with whatever your degree is. You will get a job doing whatever it is you want to do. And somebody will discover, you know how to program? And then you'll end up being a software developer for the rest of your life. And this is because there's more than twice as many jobs as there are degrees in computing. Bureau of Labor Statistics, the numbers change from time to time, but generally it's between 2 and 3 times as many jobs in software development as there are people with a degree in it. And that's part of the reason there's a lot of bad code out there. It's because a lot of the people that are writing it have never actually taken a class, and they've certainly never taken very many classes. Okay? And so they're making it up as they go along. So the code, the programs you run, somebody made them up, right? Somebody just came up with what they ought to do and tried something out, and it kind of worked, and it broke occasionally, and oh well, right? And you're sort of already at that point. So what we're going to try to do is give you some pointers, some things you can use to do that better. We'll also try to give you some practical experience with some of these ideas as we move forward. 5 minutes is not enough for my next topic. Are there any parting questions? Then I will see you all on Wednesday.